The story that I told in connection with the Machlokes that rose between the Nitziv and Rabbi Sisbeah after the death of Rabbi Elazar Yitzchok Fried in Volozhin. Rabbi Elazar Yitzchok Fried was the son-in-law of Rabbi Yitzchok Mevolozhin, who was the son of the Chaim Volozhin. When Rabbi Yitzchok Mevolozhin passed away, his older son-in-law, Rabbi Elazar Yitzchok, became the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. The Nitziv was the younger son-in-law of Rabbi Elazar Yitzchok Fried. The Nitziv was the youngest son-in-law of Rabbi Yitzchok Mevolozhin. Then, when Rabbi Elazar Yitzchok Fried, the older son-in-law of Rabbi Yitzchok Mevolozhin, passed away, so a machlokes developed between two candidates, Rabbi Sisbeah, Rabbi Chaim father, and the Nitziv. Now, I don't have to mention that I am completely impartial in respect to this litigation in view of the fact that both were ancestors of mine. So, the student body at the Yeshiva of Volozhin, that was 90 years ago, was split. One faction of the student body was on the side of Rabbi Yisrael, and the other faction was on the side of the Nitziv. And this conflict could not be resolved among themselves. Consequently, they decided to summon three Gdolim to decide who should be the Rosh Hashiv. Now, the Nitziv won in this litigation. The three Gdolim that were summoned to decide this question were Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan and Rabbi Tevel Miminsk, that's the author of the Nachas Dorit. You know Nachas Dorit, Amalekhan, who was himself a Talmud Muvik of Rabbi Chaim Volozhin. And the third was the Magid of Vilna. In Vilna, they had a tradition since the time of the Goen not to refer to anyone as the Rav of Vilna, out of respect to the Goen of Vilna. So the Magid of Vilna really fulfilled all the functions of the Rav. That was the name of that Magid of Vilna, was Reb Feivel. Now, Reb Feivel, he presided over the Beis Din. And when he opened the discussion, so he said, "This week for me is like the week of Ayesha." Now, I'm a Magid in Vilna, and I'm accustomed every Shabbos to discuss the Parshas HaShavua. And in the discussion of the Parshas HaShavua, I always draw a contrast between the saint in the Parsha and the villain in the Parsha. And I never have any difficulty in drawing this contrast. I always find in the Sedra a saint and a villain. In Breishis, so I draw a contrast between Cain and Hevel. Cain is the villain and Hevel is the saint. In Neach, I draw a contrast between Neach and the Deir HaMabel. Neach is the saint and the Deir HaMabel are the villains, and so on. But when it comes to Vayeshev, so I become completely dumbfounded, because to draw a contrast between Yosef and his brothers would mean, Chas V'Shalom, to refer to the Shvatim as villains and Yosef as a saint. And how can I do such a thing, when we all know that the Shvatim were also saints, in spite of the fact that the deeds they committed were so shocking that on the surface they do not seem to be explicable. For that reason, on Shabbos Vayeshev, I refrain from speaking. This is one Shabbos that I take off. Now, he said, this machlokes between the Nitziv and Rabbi Sisbeah is Parsha Vayeshev. I cannot speak because they are both gaining and they are both tzaddikim. Now, you see that I am not like that. I mentioned that story a year ago, and I reiterate that story just to point out that I'm not like the Magid of Vilna. The Magid of Vilna was a free agent, but I'm not a free agent. So I have to deliver Ashkokishi on part of Ayesha. Now, in the course of this discussion, you'll probably find many points that I mentioned last year. The Torah begins with the incident of Yosef's repetition of his dreams before his brothers. But this narration is preceded by a statement that Yaakov showed more love towards Yosef than towards the other children. And this special love was manifested by Ksenia's spy. That is a jacket with many colors. Now it is self-evident that the brothers of Yosef were not little children who were jealous of a jacket, a striped jacket. This Ksenia's passing probably represented a certain kind of a uniform. Just as today, so distinction is manifested by uniform. So then too, the Ksenia's passing was symbolic of a certain excellence that Yosef attained according to Yaakov. It was not the jacket in itself that they envied, but the love, the special love that Yaakov entertained and showed towards Yosef. Why did Yaakov love Yosef more than any other child? The Torah tells us that the reason was because he was even skunim. Nicholas translates even skunim in the sense of bachakim, a wise son. And Rashi says that ben skunim means shehoyo zivi kunim shalei deimalei. Literally, it means the facial expression of Yosef was the same as the facial expression of Yaakov. But it's not just a matter of physical features. Now, yesterday, a mandate was imposed upon me, I think, by Michelson and by Horowitz, that I discuss the distinction between a Rebbe and a Moira. Now, you said that I should devote the service as coffee share to the discussion of that. You forgot already. So, now I said, I retorted that I don't see how it could fit in to the Ashkofishi of Vayeshev. But after thinking about it, so I realized that it fits well into Vayeshev. Now, I mentioned yesterday in the Shia, the Rambam, that when a Talmud initiates a greeting towards his Rebbe, so we have to say to him, Shalom Alecho Rabbi. However, if the Rebbe initiated a greeting, and the Talmud has to respond, so we have to say, Shalom Alecho Rabbi Umeir. The question was, what is the difference between Rabbi and Moir? Now, Rabbi, you know, is a Rabbi. Moir means a teacher. You refer to the teachers in high school and in college as Moir, as a Moir. To a Gemara teacher, you refer as to a Rabbi. Now, that doesn't mean that you have more respect and more love towards the Gemara teachers than towards the college teachers. But this is just a coincidence that to teachers of secular subjects, you refer to by the term Moir. And a teacher of Torah, you refer to by the name of Rabbi. We see that the Rabbi fulfills two functions, because when he responds to a greeting, So the Talmud has to say, Shalom Alecho Rabbi Umeir. We say, for example, Moireinu Verabin. So it means that the Rebbe of Torah is a Moire as well as a Rebbe. What is the difference between a Moire and the Rebbe? Now, it seems to me that the reason as to why Yaakov showed special love toward Yosef is because, as Rashi says, the Yunkel is still in Bahakimule, Kol Masher, Lomad Mishem Vei Vei Amosale. Rashi doesn't say Limoid Lo, but Mosale. There is a distinction between Lilamoid and Mosea. We say Meshe Kibul Teiro Misinai U Misoro Lehu Yishua. The Yishua is King. Now, we find, I think it is in Parshat Kudei, at the end of Kudei, Kichela Shativo Adishem is Meshek in Osub Ne Yisrael is Kolarido, Vayam Meshek Kolam Locho, Vine Yosu Isok Ashativo Adishem Kein Osub, Vayvorech Isamish. It seems that there is a repetition in these two psalms. First, the Torah tells us that the Israelites performed and built, performed all, everything according to the specifications by God. And then again, it reiterates, then Moshe conferred his blessing upon them. Apparently, the Avodas HaMishkan represented or had two aspects. It had the aspect of Avodo and it had the aspect of Miroch. Avodo means service, work. An Eved is one who performs menial labor. Miroch really means artistic work. When a person performs Avodo, so the Avodo that he performs is extraneous to the person. There is no imminent relationship between the worker and the work that he performs. But Melacha has reference to an artistic piece of work. When an artist creates something, so it is not only an avodo, it is a melacha, simply because the artist injects his own personality into the piece of art. Now, the Avodas HaMishkan involves two aspects. First of all, the Israelites were required to do all the work of the involved in building and in the various Klei HaMishkan according to the specifications given by God. That's not later. But then, the Mishkan could not serve as a source of inspiration for the Jews unless Bezalel and all the Israelites who participated in the building of the Mishkan injected their personality into the Mishkan. That was a piece of art. That was Milan. Now, the Torah says in Parashat Pinchas, "Vayimah Adishem Omeishe Kach Lichores Yishua B'Mun Asher Warbe V'Samach Dosh Yocholom." That means Yeshua is your Talmud, and you will ordain him. Va'amarito isi l'shnei Reza Akein v'l'shnei Koleido v'tzivisa isi l'inea. V'nosato mehit cholof. You will bestow from your glory upon him l'man yishmiu kolarat nisva. In order that he might be in a position to inspire the people. Yeshua was not only to have a Talmud more relationship with Moshe Rabbeinu, but he was also to have a Rebbe Talmud relationship. Now, a Moré is one who teaches. He performs work. He doesn't have either. He might perform the work very efficiently and very brilliantly, according to plan. But the metatrots, and the teacher himself are two different things. When a Moré teaches, then he does not inject his personality into the disciple. A professor of physics, of mathematics, might be an ardent Nazi. And the students who study physics in his class might be Jews. Planck was a professor of physics. He was an ardent Nazi. He had many Jewish students. Did that mean that he was not a good teacher? He was a very good teacher. But he was only a Moré. A Rebbe is one who bestows from his glory upon the pupil. That means Mosa, to turn over. He injects his own personality into the Talmud. And the degree of indoctrination affected by Rebbe is not directly proportional to the quantity of knowledge that was acquired by the Talmud from the Rebbe. Now, the term Rebbe was applied to the Hasidic Rebbe more than to the Misnagdish Rabbon. We all know that. He was called, the Hasidic Rebbe was called Rebbe by everyone. By all the Hasidim. Men, women, alike. Does that mean that every Hasidic Rebbe who was called Rebbe by his Hasidim, that he indoctrinated his Hasidim in the realm of knowledge? There are many Hasidim who did not acquire any knowledge whatsoever from the Rebbe. Still, they consider the Rebbe as a Rebbe. Why? Because he injected his personality into them. That's a Rebbe. And Moré is one who just performs an avoda of teaching efficiently and systematically, and he enables the disciple to acquire knowledge. Now, it goes without saying that all the children of Yaakov were disciples of Yaakov. They learned something from Yaakov. They all learned about the great heritage of Avraham. But there was a distinction between the way Yosef learned and his brothers learned, and the way his brothers learned. Between Yaakov and the other sons, there was a Moire Talmud relationship. There was no Messiah. He could not turn over. He could not bestow his glory upon them. He could not inject his personality into them. Their facial expressions did not become the identical of Yaakov's facial expression. The Zivikuni Shalohem was not normal Yaakov. However, in regard to Yosef, true, there was a Moré Talmud relationship, but in addition to this Moré Talmud relationship, there was a Rebbe Talmud relationship. Consequently, he was able to turn over, not just to teach, but to turn over. He was able to inject his personality into Yosef, and this is the reason as to why Yaakov loved him more. Because the reason as to why there was a Rebbe Talmud relationship between Yaakov and Yosef, and not between Yaakov and the other children, was due to the fact that Yosef, more than any other of Yaakov's children, wanted to have this relationship with Yaakov. The other children did not want, they did not try to establish a Rebbe Talmud relationship. They only wanted to maintain a Moré Talmud relationship, professor-student relationship. Now, his brothers were envious, not of the Ksenis Pasim in itself. They were envious of the Ksenis Pasim because it symbolized the excellence of Yosef. In that, he was able to establish a Rebbe Talmud relationship between himself and his father. They were not able. But The question arises, why is it that Yosef was able to establish a rabbi-talmid relationship between himself and his father, and the other sons of Yaakov were not able? It's not that they didn't want to. If they had been reluctant to establish a rabbi-talmid relationship between themselves and their father, so then they shouldn't have been envious of Yosef. Why be envious? They didn't want to such a relationship to exist. They didn't want that Yaakov should bestow his own glory upon them, should inject his personality into them. So why should they be jealous of Yosef? Obviously, they really wanted to have that relationship. Without that relationship, they felt alone and isolated. They realized that Yosef, on account of this Rebbe Talmid relationship, on account of the fact that Zivikunin Shalei Zomel Yaakov was never alone. And they were always alone, even in the company of their own. So why were they not able to maintain this Rebbe Talmid relationship between themselves and Yaakov? So the answer is given in the next psukim that follow. Vayachlein Yosef chaleim vayagit le'achov vayosifu oitzno Yosef. Yosef was a dreamer. He dreamt. And on account of this dream, they hated him even more. Apparently, the dream capacity of Yosef was at the core of this hatred and this jealousy. And not only that, Yosef did not content himself with being a mere dreamer, but he liked to elaborate upon his dreams, to repeat the dreams over and over again. And he repeated his first dream. What was the dream? V'ne anachnu mi'almi malumim b'sei chasode v'ne komo alemosi v'gam nitzovo v'hine yifisu beno alemoseichem v'atashtichazeno alemosi. In his first dream, he envisioned his old brothers, all the sons of Yaakov, binding sheaves of corn, and he being standing among them and binding his own sheaf of corn, and that the sheaves of the other brothers stood upright and they bowed to his own sheaf. The brothers understood the symbolism that was involved in this dream, and they rebuked him. And they said to him, "Hamolich tim lecholeinu im moshel tim shel banu? Do you think that you can reign over us? You can dominate us?" They thought that this dream of Yosef reflected an aspiration of by Yosef to dominate over his brothers. The brothers of Yosef were very well aware of the fundamental fact that is mentioned in Chazal and is conceded by modern psychology, that the dreams of a person at night reflect the thoughts and the desires, even the suppressed desires and thoughts of a person. What is suppressed into the background during the waking hours comes into the foreground when a person is asleep. So they understood that if Yosef at night dreamt of sheaves of corn bowing to his sheaf, it meant that during the waking hours, Yosef was striving towards dominion, towards domination. So their hatred towards him was multiplied. Then he dreamt another dream, and that was Hashemesh v'ayoreach v'chadosho kechovim mishtachav, of the sun and the moon and the various stars bowing to him. And this time, the Torah tells us v'aykanu v'yachov. It seems that with the repetition of his first dream, only the hatred of the brothers was multiplied, but not the majority. However, when he repeated the second dream, so not only the hatred was multiplied, but the envy as well. Why is it so? But in order to understand the reason as to why the brothers resented the dreams of Yosef so much, so we have to take cognizance of the fact that members of the human race are divided into two categories. One category consists of dreamers, or I can use another expression instead of dreamers, saying idealists. An idealist is a dreamer. And when I say a dreamer, I don't mean one who dreams at night while he's asleep. Every person dreams at night. There is not a single person in the world who doesn't dream. But I mean a dreamer in the sense that he dreams in the waking hours of his life. The dream at night is only the barometer of the character of the person and of the dreams that he conceives during the waking hours. So there are persons who are dreamers, idealists, and there are persons who do not dream, who are realists. Now, most people are realists, not idealists, not dreamers. Yaakov himself was a dreamer, because Yaakov dreamt of Yisua Mutavarto V'Roishei Magia HaShomai. That was a dream. If Rashi says that Yosef was the identical copy of Yaakov, Rashi does not mean he was the identical copy in his physical features, but it means the spiritual image of Yosef was the same as the spiritual image of Yaakov. Why? Simply because Yaakov was a dreamer and Yosef was a dreamer. The brothers of Yosef were not dreamers. They were realists. Now, what is the difference between a dreamer, an idealist, and a realist? Now, a realist is one who is satisfied with the status quo of the world. The Yevonim, we are approaching Hanukkah now. Actually, the struggle between Hellenism and Yadus was the struggle between idealism and realism. The Yevonim, the ancient Greeks, the Hellenists were realists. A realist is one who is satisfied with the world. The world in its present condition, the way it is. A realist is satisfied with nature and its primitivity, the way it is. A realist is satisfied with human nature, with all its brutalities, with all its cruelty, with all its wickedness, with all the voluptuous desires, the tyrants of man. The pagans were realists. Hence, the deification of nature and the deification of the animal instincts raging within men by the ancient Greeks. Why did they deify the instincts of men? Because they were contented with the status quo of the world. They thought that the world was perfect. If the world is perfect, then all the instincts of men, in all its brutality and voluptuousness, is ideal. In the mentality of the pagans, therefore, the pagans addicted themselves to what they called physical beauty and to sensuality. Because they considered nature in all its primitivity, in all its crudeness, as being perfect. This is a realist. A realist is one who is satisfied with what he is and with what the world is. But Yadus runs counter to this idea that men should be satisfied with what it is. Yadus says, Izeu Rosh Hirasameya Bichalkei, a man should be contented with his lot, with his chilek, with what he possesses, with that which is extraneous to his own being. But a person should never be contented with his own being. A person should not think that the way he is, that's perfection. A person should never think that the way the world is perfection. If he allows himself to be swayed by this dangerous notion that the world is perfect, then there can't be any progress. Then he's bound to become engulfed by the moral abyss. Yadu says, he has to be contented with his possessions, regardless the magnitude of his possessions, whether he has riches or he's poor, because the possession is something extraneous to the person. But a person should never be contented with his own being. Paganism says just the reverse. A person ought to be contented with what he is, with what the world is, but he should not be contented with what he possesses. He should always strive to attain more and more. So, a realist is one who accepts the grim realities of life, and he doesn't consider it as grim. He considers the realities of life as perfect, as ideal. There is nothing to be improved upon. Consequently, he has no reason to dream. An idealist is one who is contented with the external things of life, with his lot in life, and the other healthy. But he is always unhappy with himself. He's unhappy with mankind as a whole. But an idealist believes that there is a discrepancy between the actualities of men and the potentialities of men. He is not enthusiastic of the actualities of men. He's not impressed with the demeanor of man as it actually manifests itself. But he is impressed, an idealist is impressed with the potentialities of men. He's convinced that men can attain the greatest heights. But he's not contented with the heights that men have so far attained. Consequently, he always strives to attain more and more. Now, when I say idealist is one who believes that the world is not perfect, man is imperfect, but at the same time, this conviction that man is imperfect is coupled with an equally strong conviction that man has the potentiality to attain the greatest height. This is idealism. But there are two kinds of idealists. Idealism is not something that is always laudable. There is good idealism and there is false idealism. Now, a Novi is certainly an idealist. A Novi is a dreamer. A Novi is one who tries to change the world, to change men. But the Torah speaks of a Novi Oemes, and the Torah speaks of a Novi Asheta. They are true idealists, and they are false idealists. They are true dreamers, and they are false dreamers. It doesn't mean that every idealist has to be adored. Many idealists brought ruin upon the world. Now, the early ideologists of communism and anarchism were idealists. They were dreamers. They were dissatisfied with the world. They tried to change the world. But did they convert the world into something better? No. They brought havoc and ruin upon the world. Why? They wanted Vim Shkorim, Rabbi Asheka. But they were dreamers. Inasmuch as they were dissatisfied with the status quo. Now, the ancient Greeks were realists. Consequently, they believe that man has to adapt himself to all the natural instincts that inhere in man. And the Jews, the Prussian, they were idealists. They believed the world is imperfect, very imperfect. God created the world in an imperfect form, as I mentioned several times, because God wanted men to become a partner with him in the fashioning of a new and better world. Man certainly was created in imperfect form. If he allows himself to be swayed by his instincts, he can turn into a beast. But man has the potentiality to attain great heights. And therefore, according to Yadus, man has to be on the alert as to the constant struggle that he has to conduct against various destructive forces, physically destructive and spiritually destructive forces in the world. Now, Yadus is based upon idealism, but Yaakov's dream gave vent to the idealism of Yadus, that is Sulo Mutzav Arzor Vereishi Magia Shemayim. True, we cannot be satisfied with the status quo. We have to aspire toward the change, toward an improvement, toward progress. We have to keep on climbing and ascending higher and higher on the rungs of the ladder whose apex reaches into heaven. But at the same time, Yaakov's idealism was affected by a realistic foundation. There must be a ladder. A ladder that stands upon earth, upon solid ground. Now, I mentioned that the Yevonim were realists. The Prushim were idealists. The Tzedukim were also realists. Consequently, they believed that the Jews ought to assimilate themselves and to adapt themselves to the general environment. The overwhelming majority of the Tzedukim became integrated within the Misyavnim group. They were realists. They were satisfied with the conditions as they were. But how about the Nisim? The Nisim were not realists. They were idealists. But they were false dreamers, false idealists. Why were the Nisim false idealists? Because they envisioned only a ladder whose apex reaches into heaven. But they did not envision any foundation upon earth. There is no mutavah. But the idealism of Yadus, the idealism as it is expressed in the dream of Yaakov, is an idealism that is qualified by a realistic foundation. There has to be a sulam mutzavarto v'reishe magia shemayim. So in other words, Yadus is not dedicated to the concept of pure idealism, but actually it is a synthesis between idealism and realism. And it seems to me that this concept of a synthesis between idealism and realism is implicit in the expression Derech Eretz. V'yosafto di gonecho, so the Gemara says in Broches, Haneid bohen yinag Derech Eretz. Sheyei yodom chirish bishor shebni yodom chirishim, ויריה בישור שבני אודם זהירים, ניטיה בישור שבני אודם מיתים, אידיה בישור שבני אודם מיתים. In other words, a Jew is to participate in the upbuilding of the world, to do whatever is necessary for the upbuilding of the world. Now, why the expression Derech Eretz? It seems that the expression Derech Bni Odom would be a much more appropriate expression. Derech Bni Odom. Because it is natural for a man to participate in the upbuilding of the world in Yisrael. Why derech eretz, derech eretz means that a person is to deport himself in accordance with the manner of the earth. Now the earth does not plant, does not sow, does not till. What does it mean, derech eretz? Now, I think, maybe I mentioned it last year, I don't remember, that this expression, derech eretz, is actually based upon the Copernican notion that the earth revolves around the sun. That the earth revolves around the sun. Now, that idea was considered heresy by the church. Why? Because of the prophet in Yeshua of Shemesh be given day, which seems to imply that the sun revolves around the earth. The truth is, however, that the Zohar in Parsha Vayikra says that the earth revolves around the sun, not the sun around the earth. Why did Yeshua say Shemesh be given day? Because we still say sunset, sunrise. And even astronomers who are convinced of the Copernican idea will also say sunset and sunrise. So the earth, actually, the derech eretz, has two aspects, has two orbits. The path of the earth consists of two orbits. There is the earth makes a complete revolution around its own axis each day. That's one aspect of the earth, of the derech eretz. But then, in the course of 365 days, so the earth makes a revolution around the sun. Now, these two revolutions of the earth represent the two dreams of Yosef. Actually, Yosef was the zivut kunin of Yaakov. He was a dreamer like the same way as Yaakov was. He was an idealist. Yaakov's idealism was qualified by a realistic foundation. So was Yosef's idealism qualified by a realistic foundation. But Yosef was an analyst. He analyzed Yaakov's dream. What Yaakov envisioned in one dream, Yosef envisioned in two separate dreams. Why? We'll soon see. But actually, the two dreams of Yosef are the two components of Yaakov's one dream. Yaakov dreamt of Yisroel Mutarat of Reishim Adi Hashemayim. There must be, of course, the world as it is imperfect. It has to be improved upon. Man, in his primitive form, is brutal. And he's driven by certain animal instincts. But it is within the potential of man to soar above these brutal and voluptuous inclinations. And it is incumbent upon men to keep on climbing upon the rungs of the ladder, which will lead him to heaven. But unlike the Ethiopian who tried to build bridges in the air without any foundation and who wanted to isolate themselves from the community and to deny to themselves all the joys of life, so Yaakov dreamed that there must be a solid ground upon which the ladder can stand. And unlike the idealists who tried to attain a utopia through force and through radical means, by means of revolution and war, so Yaakov envisioned progress that is gradual. Now, the Derech Lover, they're also idealists. Now, you have to keep in mind that when I say idealist, it does not mean that we have to adore it. There might be false prophets, false idealists, false dreamers. But the Deir HaFuego, the people of the Deir HaFuego were idealists. They were not contented with the status quo. They wanted a new order. And they wanted to attain great heights. And the tower was merely a symbol, as the Arav Amiri says in his Akdomah to his Perush, a voice. It was merely a symbol of their concept of progress. The tower. So they also dreamt of climbing up high unto heaven. But there were two fundamental differences between the dream of the Deir HaFuego and the dream of Yaakov. These differences were the following. First, in the dream of the Deir HaFuego, God was not included. He tried to ascend heaven, just as man today tries to ascend heaven. But God is not included. And if God is not included in a dream, then the dream is unavoidably bound to be a failure. Then there was another difference. The Tower of Babel had no steps, no rungs. You cannot climb up a tower just gradually, rung by rung, step by step. You need a rocket to climb up a Tower of Babel. This is like the dream of modern men. But in the dream of Yaakov, it was a ladder with rungs and step, one step, another step. You cannot attain happiness for mankind through radical methods by means of revolution. It can only bring misery to the world. The sublimest ideal, if it is endeavored to be realized through radical means, is bound to bring misery upon mankind. But the only way to attain an ideal is by a gradual process of progress, of climbing up, rung by rung, step by step. Sulam Musaf Arto, Vereshim Agiya Shemaimo, Umalachi Elikim, Eilim V'Yerdimbo. The Yisim were idealists, false idealists, because they did not recognize the importance of having a solid foundation upon which the ladder can stand. This is the reason as to why this movement of the Essenes ultimately culminated into Christianity. And then we know the repercussions of that movement. Because it was a dream of Reshim Adi HaShemayimo without a Sulam Mutavah. But Yaakov envisioned it in one dream. Yosef, however, analyzed it into two separate dreams. Now, Anachnu Ma'omim Alumim B'Sechasodeh, what does it represent? It represents the Sulam Mutavav. Now, Yaakov, Yosef was dreaming of a controlled economy, as he did realize this dream in saving Egypt from starvation. So he planned the economy. Yosef felt that the conditions in the world, the way they existed in his time, were not good. All the wealth was concentrated in Pharaoh's hands, and it was not even used for the welfare of the community. So there had to be a war. A famine had to break out. It was unavoidable. Because Pharaoh's regime represented corruption and inequality. And throughout the ancient world, there was such a system of inequality. And Joseph was not contented with the economic insecurity and with the social inequality that prevailed in those days. And he dreamt of changing the world. Not changing through radical methods, that is impossible, but gradually. So he dreamt of a controlled economy. Controlled for the welfare of the whole community. That represents the Sulamut of Arto aspect of Yaakov's dream. But then, the other aspect, the more important aspect of Roshei Magi HaShemayimo, of spiritual and moral values, that he envisioned in the second dream, in the dream of Vayachlim Uitchalimachir, of Hashemesh V'Ayoreach V'Hadosar Kichovim Mishtachlam. And he didn't dream of any worship, Chas V'Sholem. Now, ishtachvoyin is just an expression of adoration, of recognition. Now, in the ancient days, so it was customary to greet an important person by means of bowing, the same way as we greet by means of hello. And even today we bow as a manifestation of respect. So in this second dream he envisioned the Rishon Magia HaShemayim. Now, when Yosef repeated his first dream, so they hated him. But their jealousy was not multiplied therefrom. It's only Vayosifu it's no Yosef al Chalameis of Aldros. But when he repeated a second dream, then their jealousy was multiplied. Why? Because when he repeated his first dream, so the Shvatim tried to deceive themselves that Yosef will not really be the successor of Yaakov's heritage. Why? Because they saw Yaakov dreamt of Isulam Mutavat of Reishi Magi HaShemayim, of spiritual and moral values, of Almighty God standing on the apex of the ladder. What does Yosef dream of? Of economic security, of material things. He will not be Yaakov's successor. So there is no reason as to why they should be jealous of him. But when he repeated the second dream, the dream which has as its subject matter spiritual and moral values, those values that emanate light unto the world, so then they realized that Zivikunin Shel Yosef, they merely Zivikunin Shel Yaakov, he is going to be the spiritual successor of Yaakov. And the thoughts presented to their mind that maybe they will be deprived of all salvation. Maybe their spiritual lot will be the same as the lot of Esau. Maybe the Olam Habo, with all its blessings, is destined to be the lot of Yosef, not theirs. The jealousy was therefore multiplied. And now we can understand as to why the brothers were envious of the special love that Yaakov showed towards Yosef. Now the question arose, if they wanted to have a Rebbe Talmid relationship between Yaakov and themselves, so why did not they try to be Talmidim of a Rebbe rather than Talmidim of a Mora of Yaakov? Well, the answer is this. In what realm can a teacher fulfill the function of a Mora? And what realm can a teacher fulfill the function of a rabbi? Now I mentioned, why the expression minag d'acharet? Because man is to conform to the path that is followed by the earth itself in its two orbits, in its orbit around its own axis, and in its orbit around the sun. On one hand, the earth stands on solid ground. It keeps on revolving every day on its own axis. It is satisfied with its status quo. With its own axis. Keeps on revolving around its axis. That's a realistic approach taken by earth. But on the other hand, the earth is not so much in love with the status quo. It keeps on revolving around the sun, deviating from the status quo to get some light from the sun. It's progressing towards the sun. This was the dream of Yaakov. true, a man has to strive toward heights, but he cannot climb in the air. He has to stand on solid ground. And when he does climb up high, he must do it gradually, step by step, rung by rung. He has to make a revolution around the sun, but at the same time, he has to stand on solid ground and to revolve around his own axis. How does a person adopt the Minigra Heret? If he plants when it is necessary to plant, he sows when it is necessary to sow, he tills the soil when it is necessary, when he does everything that is indispensable towards the upbuilding of the world and towards progress. That's the Suwamut of Arthur aspect. That's the Mi'almi Malumi. He made a Bishosh of the Automate. But he cannot be contented with a revolution around one's own axis. The world is imperfect. Man is very imperfect. He has to improve. He has to change the world and fashion a better world. So he has to keep on revolving around the sun, around all these spiritual and moral values that emanate life unto mankind. So, the relationship of Rebbe and Talmud has to be applied in the realistic, in the idealistic realm. The relationship of Moreh and Talmud has to be applied in the realistic realm. Now, when a teacher has to indoctrinate a student in the knowledge of mathematics, so there he has to adopt the approach of a realist. There he has to adopt the approach of a realist. So he cannot instruct and enable the student to acquire knowledge simply by injecting his personality into the student. One cannot learn mathematics by absorbing the personality of the teacher. He can get off his mind by absorbing the personality of the teacher, but he cannot acquire any knowledge. So in the realistic realm, the Talmud-Moreh relationship has to be adopted. In the realm of idealism, you cannot apply the Talmud-Moreh relationship. There you have to apply the Moreh, the Rebbe-Talmud relationship, because you have to inject your personality into the Talmud. You have to bestow your own glory upon him. Otherwise, he cannot become an idealist. How can he become an idealist? The Rebbe might be the greatest idealist, and he might have a Talmud who will study under him for years and years. But he will remain a realist unless the Rebbe tries to bestow his hood upon him. So, in Jewish tradition, a rabbi, a teacher, had to fulfill two functions. He had to fulfill the function of a moreh, of teaching, in the realm of realism, because Yadus does not believe in pure and absolute idealism. Yadus believes in a combination of idealism and realism. Idealism that is qualified by a realistic foundation. So there are two realms into which a teacher is to indoctrinate the students. In the realm of realism, he is to serve in the capacity of a moreh. But in the realm of idealism, he is to serve in the capacity of a rabbi. Now, what does Rebbe mean? Rebbe really, literally, it means master. But it doesn't mean that he dominates him. It means he masters the personality of the Talmud. So that the Talmud begins to think the same way as the Rebbe does and to feel the same way as the Rebbe does. So, Yosef's excellence consisted in the fact, as Rashi says, that Shemosalei Kolma Shed Lomad Mishem Veiva. There was a Talmud Rebbe relationship between Yaakov and the brothers of Yosef, There wasn't that relationship. Why wasn't there that relationship? Because they didn't want. They were jealous of that relationship. They were jealous of that Xenus passion which symbolized this excellence of Joseph. But they could not maintain this relationship. Why? Because the brothers of Joseph were realists. They were contented with the world. Then they adopted, in their demeanor, the realistic approach. So there could not be any Rebbe-Talmid relationship. Because in the realistic realm, there can only be a Mora-Talmid relationship, not a Rebbe-Talmid relationship. Now, Yosef was the Zivikunin of Yaakov. And as I mentioned before, he analyzed Yaakov's one dream into two components. Now the question arises, why did Yosef have to analyze Yaakov's one dream into two separate components, into two separate dreams? The answer is that Yosef realized that Yaakov's dream, as it was envisioned by Yaakov, is to apply in all times. However, the form of the dream might sometimes change. In Yaakov's dream, the vision of social equality, of social justice, of righteousness, of economic security was considered as part and parcel of one dream with the vision of spiritual facts. That he envisioned spiritual progress, where he saw angels going up and down on the ladder. In the same dream where he beheld God himself, he also beheld social equality and economic security, the summa motzavah. And that form, that expression, was good as long as Yaakov was able to live in his own Jewish environment. Then Yaakov didn't have to treat spiritual questions by themselves and economic and social matters by themselves. They could all be considered and treated together as part and parcel of one plan, of one vision, of one dream. But with the Jews going into exile, with Yosef becoming the prime minister in Egypt, then it was impossible for Yosef to treat of the economic problems as part and parcel with all spiritual and moral matters. Now I mentioned last week in connection with the prophet in Vayishlach So, on the surface, there appears to be a contradiction. First, God says to Yaakov, Shimcha Yaakov, and then he says, Lo Yikor Shimcha Yaakov. So the Gemara reconciles this apparent conflict by saying, Lo Yishishiyok Yashem Yaakov, El Shem Yaakov Nisha, Vishem Yisrael Yik. So that means, as we explained it last week, that in respect to economic, social, and civic matters, then your name Yaakov will be retained. Then you can be motivated by the concept that is implicit in the name of Yaakov. What does Yaakov mean? It means that Yaakov holds on to Esav's heels. There is integration, there is mingling, there is brotherhood between Yaakov and Esav. However, in regard to spiritual and moral matters, then you cannot be motivated by the concept that is implicit in the name of Yaakov. There you have to be alone, there you have to be isolated. There you have to struggle. There cannot be any interfaith movement. Ve'etz Yisrael, so Rishonim Rekim V'Manoshim. Before God, you respect the spiritual matters, so you have to struggle with all of mankind. You have to be alone. Alone with God. But not with anybody else. So that means that the girl of Yaakov meant that certain matters are to be treated separately from other matters. The economic and social and civic matters were to be treated as a separate problem, apart from the spiritual and moral matters. That was the unfortunate thing for Yaakov, Chelik. Why? Because of his destiny among the nations of the world. So it was impossible for Yaakov throughout the generations in exile to treat social and economic and civic matters as part and parcel of one vision. How could it be possible? If you respect the social and economic matters, so we have to be motivated by the concept of Yaakov, of integration and mingling and brotherhood, and respect the spiritual matters, we have to be motivated by the concept of isolation and uniqueness and aloneness in the world. So the social matters and the economic matters could not be treated as part and parcel of the same unified problem. Couldn't. The two could be treated as part and parcel of the same problem. We may say Moshiach, when it will be called Zefich Eskol Amin, Sosho Pruro, Vikrei Kulon B'Shem Arishem, Ulov Dei Shrei Mechot, then it will be possible to maintain integration and mingling with the non-Jews, and at the same time to maintain the Israel. Because all of mankind will acknowledge the concepts of Kedusha. All of mankind will say Mei Shemes Itaros Emes. But until that day will come, and while the Jews are still compelled to live among the nations of the world, and we are to assert our own uniqueness in all spiritual matters, so we cannot treat the social and economic matters, along with the spiritual matters, as part and parcel of one problem, of one question. No! Yaakov dreamt of Yisrael Mu'atzavarts of Reisha Adi Hashemayimo, of economic concepts along with spiritual concepts as part and parcel of one vision. And that was applicable in Eretz Yisrael before the children of Yaakov were compelled to go into exile and to live among pagans. But the moment Joseph had to be taken into Egypt, so the same dream had to be applied, the same dream, the same content, but a different expression had to be assumed. And therefore, Joseph had to analyze the same dream of Yaakov without deviating in one iota from the substance of the dream. But he had to analyze it into its components, in the same way as a chemist analyzes a certain substance into its element. Well, I shouldn't say into its element. That's not a good analogy. In the same way as a chemist would analyze a mixture into the various substances. Because he's not allowed to analyze it into its elements, because then there is a chemical change. Then the dream and the vision would already be different. So only the form, a different expression had to be assumed. But the same substance, with all its attributes, we still have to, even in respect to economic matters, we are to be motivated, not by the concepts of democracy as these were asserted by Thomas Jefferson, but we have to be, in economic matters, we are to be motivated by the concepts of democracy as it is asserted in the Torah. But we have to treat it as a separate topic, but from the point of view of the Torah. So, after Joseph had repeated both dreams, so then they felt that Joseph, Bizivi Kunin Shalei, is Dome Eliakov. And And therefore, their jealousy was motivated. Now, the next question that arises is the big question that disturbed the Magyarion, on account of which he decided to refrain from talking on Shabbat Hayishus. How was it possible for the Shvatim to commit such shocking deeds, to sell their own blood? Now, here I'm going to repeat what I said last year. Now, the Haftorah of this Shabbos gives a clue to this, to the puzzle that is involved in this incident. Kiyomar Hashem Ma'osleisho Pishe Yisrael Falabor Lo Yashivenu Al Michon Baketev Tzadik V'Evyonim Ba'avru Na'aloi. Chazal say that the expression by the Novi of Evyonim Ba'avru Na'aloi has reference to the crime that was committed by the brothers of Yosef. Because when the brothers of Yosef sold Yosef as a slave, so they received a certain shkolim in exchange. These shkolim they used for the purpose of buying shoes for themselves. Now, of course, it cannot be explained literally. First of all, a literal explanation of this Maimah Chazal would run counter to the plain meaning of the whole Seder. It is manifest from this Seder that the motive behind these deeds was not pecuniary greed, but it was jealousy. So it was not because of money, because of shoes. And then how can one conceive of such a barbarity that they would sell the brother in order to have money with which to buy shoes? That sounds preposterous. Doesn't even seem that the brothers of Yosef were so impoverished and so destitute that they did not have money to buy shoes. But now the Aloyim, the Novi, and the Chazal serves as a symbol. Now the Torah has a parasha of Chlitze. Now what does the parasha of Chlitze tell us? So the mitzvah, primarily the mitzvah is Yib. In order to prevent the wiping out of the name of the deceased. So Yishua kachas Yivimte. They also Yivimte Hasharo El Askeni. They Omro Mein Yivomi Lihokim Liochiv Shem BeYisrael LiOvo Yavni. So then they call Yizikne Yirei VeDibro Elof VeYomad VeYomar LiChofatzti LiKachto VeNikcho Yivimte Elof LeEne Askeni VeCholto Nali Mal Ragle VeYorko BeFonov VeYomso VeYomro Kocho Yosel Yish Asher LiYivne Es BeYisachiv VeNikcho Shmei BeYisrael BeYis Chalutana. Now this halacha has been the target, not so much by target by the goyim as by self-crowned, enlightened, free Jews. Now, they attacked it. Why did they attack it? Because, if I may quote a woman who was invited by Yeshiva University to address the student body, I won't mention her name. So she said that it was a great concession on the part of the irreligious Jews to succumb to the indignity of Chlitze, of the royal Chlitze. And that the Mapai and the Mapam did only out of consideration for unity among the Jews. But actually, this noble woman considered it as an indignity to be subjected, for a modern woman to be subjected to the indignity of Chlitze. It doesn't seem to be consistent. It doesn't seem to be consistent with modern concepts. Actually, this law, it is a hoax. I don't claim that anyone can understand. It is something that comes within the category of Chukim Shechokakti Lachem, Ein Lachem Rishus Laharben, but at the same time, it is reflective of the whole morality of the Torah, as it is distinguished from the ethical consciousness of the modern man. Now, the ethical consciousness of modern men is based upon the utilitarian concept. Now, the utilitarian concept implies that there are no absolute laws of morality. In other words, in line with what I said, I think Parshe Chayso, morality is not something that is emes. Emes means it is so because it is so, as I explained it. God is emes. Why? So the Rambam explains it. God exists not because of any external cause. God exists because he exists. Because the essence of God implies existence. So Moshe is emes, Ikeros emes. Why is it a crime to shed blood? Not because if shedding of blood is not considered as a crime, then it will become conducive to strife and to anarchy and to chaos. It is true that if shedding of blood is not condemned, so then it will become conducive to chaos. But that's not the reason. Shedding of blood is a crime because it is a crime. Why is 2 times 2 4? Why? Because it is conducive to human happiness? No. Because 2 times 2 is 4. Why is the earth round? Because it is round, that's all. Why is there a seal for? Because there is a seal for. That's the will of God. Why is there a signet? Because there is a signet. Why is there a sachmet? Because there is a sachmet. But the utilitarian concept is there are no absolute values of morality. Something is good because it is conducive to the happiness. Something is bad because it is conducive to misery. And the utilitarian concept is the most universal concept prevailing among modern men. Now, the Torah says here that if two brothers live together, and one of the brothers is an unfortunate brother, he dies without any children, and the other brother was blessed by God. The other brother is in a position to perpetuate the name of the deceased brother. The Rambam says that each widow has a sod. We don't know exactly, but the Torah tells us that by marrying the widow of the deceased brother who died without any children, he will thereby perpetuate his name. And this brother is in a position to do something for the unfortunate brother. Isn't it incumbent upon him to do that? To marry the widow of his brother? So the Torah says, Yivomo yovi oleo kochel isha yim, but vim lo yach pitzu isha kachas es yivente, vi also yivente asha alaskeni, vi omro meyin yivomo lorokim lochik shem b'Yisrael, lo yovi yam. So at first the Torah employs the term Yahpot. Then the Torah employs the term Meyin. The Torah doesn't say Viomro, Loy Chofet. Just as the Torah says at the beginning of the Patikrim, Loy Chofet. So the Torah could have said Viomro, Loy Chofet, Yivami. No, the Torah doesn't say Loy Chofet. But the Torah says Meyin. Why this change of expression? Why does the Torah begin with the term Yiloh Yachpot, and then it concludes with the term Meyeh? So apparently, the Medrash, was disturbed by this change of expression. And the Medrash says, you'll find the same Medrash in today's Sefer. And Vaimoyin Yosef, and the Pasuk of Vaimoyin Yosef. So the Medrash says like this. Lidva mitzvah, Lidva mitzvah imimani. Lidva veho imimani. Lidva mitzvah imimani. Shenema neyin yivom. Lidva veho imimani. Shenema Vaimoyin Yosef. Now what does it mean? That when a person, a Jew, is confronted with the dilemma of choosing between doing an Aveiro and not, so then he should refuse to do the Aveiro. It was Aveiro Mimar, Shenema Vaimoyin Yosef. And when one is confronted with the alternative of choosing between doing a mitzvah or not, so then he should not refuse. Shenema Meyin Yivon. Now this is very difficult, this passage of the Medrash. First of all, why do we have to resort to riots that when a person is confronted with the alternative between choosing between an Aveiro and refraining from an Aveiro, that he should refuse to, that he should not do the Aveiro? Of course, that's what Aveiro implies. What does Aveiro mean? Aveiro means he should not do it. We have to resort to riots. I mean, the whole Torah is dedicated to this concept. The person should not be addicted to Aveiro. If a person could be addicted to Aveiro, then there wouldn't be any Torah. Why not in Torah? So why resort to riots from Sukkot? And if we do have to mention a riot, that when one is confronted with a dilemma as to whether he should indulge in an Aveiro or not, so what kind of a riot is it? Now there the term Moin is used, and here the term Moin is used. So how does the use in the two parashas tend to show that we do Aveiro Mimuanim and the Amitra Mimuanim? But the answer is this, you see. Yosef, actually did not act in a natural way. Now, if Yosef had been motivated by the utilitarian concept, namely that there are no absolute values, that moral concepts vary from year to year and from place to place according to the needs and the interests of the community, then Yosef would have succumbed to temptation. Now, Yosef, psychologically, should have revolted against the heritage of Avram, which restrained him from succumbing to temptation. The brothers of his, they betrayed him. His own father was really responsible for his own tragedy. He was responsible, as the Chazal pointed out, because if it hadn't been for his sending him to Shechem, Yosef wouldn't have been sold. Yosef had to suffer because of Yaakov and because of Yaakov's sons. And then, in a pagan environment, in the land of Egypt, in a pagan culture, so Yosef was able to ascend to the greatest material heights. So much that Potiphar entrusted to him everything. So Yosef should have revolted against all the spiritual values, against the concept of absolute values of morality. He should have succumbed to temptation. So Yosef did not. Yosef actually was not adjusted to his environment. That this is what a modern psychiatrist would have said in connection with Yosef. And it's true that he was not adjusted. But a Jew has to be maladjusted in respect to spiritual matters. That is the mandate of the Jew. That is implicit in the name of Israel. One has to be maladjusted to the environment. If a spiritual question is at stake. Why? Because a Jew is to be a dreamer. He's an idealist. He should be an idealist, not a realist. A realist can make peace with adjustment. But an idealist cannot make peace with adjustment. He had to fight. But it was repugnant to reason. It was repugnant to all the psychological laws that prevail in human nature. So, the Medrash says, "Lidvaveiro mimani." Now, the Goen in his Pirush HaYishaya says that there is a distinction between Loi Chofeitz and Moi. Leucho faith means when a person refuses to do something and he bases it upon logic. Whether good logic or bad logic, he bases it upon a certain kind of logic. He gives a reason as to why he doesn't want. Then we use the expression Leucho faith. Moin means a person doesn't want, it's not even based upon logic. Why doesn't he want? It's a mere whim, a caprice. A mere caprice. It's not based upon any natural reaction. It's not based upon any logic. Now, Iktano Yonza Bimiyun. If she has no father, and the Gdushin was through the mother, so it's only the Avonon, so she can make a declaration in the presence of people, and erase the plainly, and that nullifies the Gdushin, the Rabbanon, retroactively. So she has to give a reason before the people, before Beis Din, why she doesn't want, why she wants to annul the marriage. She doesn't have to give any reason. I don't want that song. It might be a mere whim, a caprice. So it is nullified. That's mium, that's called mium. Rechofet, however, means that the person doesn't want to do something because of certain reasons. So there, the Torah says, Vayimoyin, you see. Vayimoyin. And what is the Vayimoyin? And there is a Shalsharis on the Vayimoyin. What does Shalsharis mean? He kept on stretching it out. Why did he have to stammer and to stretch it out? Because when does a person stammer? When? When a person does not really have a good way of explaining it. So then he begins to stammer. In other words, Yosef had no way of explaining it to the Ishis Potiphar. She couldn't understand. What could he tell her? She was a pagan woman. And her husband is gave him such a career. And the family of Yaakov betrayed him. How could he explain his obstinacy? His stubbornness in refusing to succumb to temptation? He couldn't explain it in a way that he could understand it. He just could say, I can do it. Why? Because we love Iramiman. Because there is a Rishinov. There is a Rishinov, not because indulgence of youth is conducive to family strife. No, that's true also. There is a Rishinov because there is a Rishinov. It's necessarily true. Just that 2 times 2 is 4. So there is an Issa against youth, against adultery, against nous. But he couldn't understand it. He had to stammer. There is a Shalsharis. Lidvaraveo is Mimon. What does Mio mean? When a person says, I don't know and I can't explain it. I can't explain it so that somebody should understand. As the Ktana says, Amy Reitz explains. She doesn't even know how to explain it. But Lidvaraveo is Mimon. Lidvaraveo is Mimon. Now here, we have a situation where two brothers live together. They live together. Now, when two brothers live together, Kiyeshuach and Yadov, so they certainly shared. They shared good moments, moments of joy and moments of misery, of sadness, of grief together. That should bring about a solidarity and a detachment between the two brothers. But the lot of one brother was an unfortunate one. He died without leaving any children. And this brother is in a position to perpetuate his name. So, isn't there a good reason as to why he should marry the widow of his brother? It could be explained. But still, the person, the brother, he comes to Bezdin and says, Eini chofetz im lo yachfetz. He doesn't say moin, ani mimoin. He says, Eini chofetz. He doesn't say that it's out of selfishness that he refuses to marry the widow of his brother. He bases it upon a psychiatrist's opinion. It's not good for him to marry the widow of the brother. Because the widow of his brother is one type and he is a different type. It wouldn't be compatible. There is no incompatibility. It wouldn't be conducive to happiness. And he could get an affidavit even by most religious and most orthodox psychiatrists. It's not good for him to marry the widow of his brother. So he says it's a matter of Leuchofetz. It's based upon logic and upon psychology and upon an analysis of the human feelings, human emotions. in accordance with the utilitarian concept, it's not good. It can only lead to misery. But still, he refrains from doing something whereby you'll be able to perpetuate the name of the brother, the dead brother. So the Torah says that then she should say, she should make a declaration, mei yivami. In other words, never mind all this rationalization about compatibility and disharmony. The real reason as to why he refuses to marry the widow, in spite of the fact that by marrying the widow of his unfortunate mother, he'll perpetuate his name, is because he's selfish. He's not motivated by altruistic considerations. He's only interested in himself, in his own happiness. He's not motivated by the concept of absolute laws of morality. He doesn't feel that certain things have to be done, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, regardless whether it will lead to happiness or misery. Certain things have to be done. It's only rationalization. It's not real logic. He thinks it's a matter of lechofetz, but actually it's mein yivami. It's just a mere whim and a caprice because he does not want to be swayed by moral considerations. And therefore, so v'nikra yivinte elov v'ein askenim, she has to take off the shoe. Now, the shoe is the symbol of adaptability. Now, one of the characteristics of all living organisms is adaptability. The fact that a living organism can adapt itself to the environment. And this is very important, a very important characteristic in the survival of all organisms. But this should be resorted only in the physical realm, but not in the spiritual realm. In the spiritual realm, then a person should not adapt himself to the environment. In the spiritual realm, he is to behave like an idealist, like a dreamer. He is to be discontented and to struggle, and he is to try to change the world. So he's trying to make him out before God, manage to struggle against the whole environment. So, in other words, he is not to adapt himself. Whenever we find in scripture that whenever a person walked upon holy ground, so he was told to take off his shoes. Why? Because a shoe is an instrument whereby one can adapt himself to an environment. Without a shoe, man is not protected against snow, against glass, against the various elements of nature. When he puts on his shoe, so he protects his feet against the various hazards that range in nature. This is an instrument whereby a person can adapt himself to the environment. So on material ground, a person can walk with shoes. Men should adapt himself to the environment to try to make his life as comfortable as possible, as long as he doesn't conflict with spiritual comfort. But on holy ground, on Mokim Kodesh, a person is not allowed to walk with his shoes on. He should not try to adapt the Torah to the demands of the society. Now this person who said, Amy Hoffings, I cannot marry the widow of the brother. Why can't he marry the widow of the brother? Because it will lead to discontent in the family. There won't be any compatibility. What does it show? It shows that he tries to apply this concept of adaptability even in the realm of spiritual values, on holy ground. And on holy ground, the person is not to resort to this concept of adaptability. Therefore, the Torah says that she should take off the shoe. She take off the shoe, thereby to symbolize that in respect to spiritual matters, you are not to be motivated by considerations of compatibility and happiness and contentment, but a person ought to do what is right because it is right, and ought to refrain from wrong because it is wrong, regardless of any utilitarian consideration. Now, the brothers of Yosef sold Yosef, not because of the shoes. They sold Yosef out of jealousy. But it wasn't just an act of revenge. They thought that Yosef, through the stories that he reported to Yaakov, was trying to impress upon Yaakov that his brothers were not following in the path of the family of Avraham. And consequently, as a result of his evil reports, So they will be divested and deprived of all the blessings. They'll be deprived of all salvation. So they decided to eliminate Yosef as a source of danger, because they thought that the end justified the means. True, selling a human being is not ethical. But here the end justifies this means. So they resorted to the concept of adaptability in spiritual matters. That was the crime. Al Michon Baketev Tzadik very important.